This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Because the media is facing a lot of, serious, precarious economic situation. And as a result of that, if this, situation continues, they are going to close. So many media houses are going to close.
That's reporter Alpha Diallo in Dakar talking about a news blackout in Senegal today to protest against economic measures that are threatening the survival of the country's media. Details coming up. Also, UN agencies warn Sudan is at a breaking point after more than 15 months of conflict. And the UN support mission in Libya says it is concerned about the recent mobilization of forces in various parts of the country. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. Senegalese news organizations widely heeded a call today for a news blackout to protest economic measures by the new government, which they say threaten the industry. Most newspapers did not publish, and two popular private radio stations played music all day instead of broadcasting the news. To brief us more on Senegal's No Press Day, I talked with reporter Alpha Diallo in Dakar a little while ago.
Today, the Senegalese media have called, a No Press Day, and this day is initiated by the Council of Press and the distributors and publishers of Senegal, SENEPS. The reason they are facing a lot of problems from the new government, that's the reason why they have just decided to initiate this day.
So, Alpha, when you say news blackout, you're talking about newspapers not publishing and radio stations just playing music instead of broadcasting the news. That's what's going on?
Exactly. That is exactly what's going on. Yes, all the big media houses, since yesterday, 12 o'clock, midnight, they have stopped news broadcasting. The only thing they are doing is they are playing music, and from time to time they put on adverts, but they are not actually doing anything regarding to the news, because the organizers, they describe the media landscape in Senegal as one of the darkest faces that the media landscape of this country is facing. One of the darkest phases in the history of this country since the arrival of this new administration 4 months ago.
So talk to us a little about that. Talk to us about the economic difficulties the media sector is facing, and talk to us about reporters' complain of this precarious working conditions in that country.
Yes, the first thing that these people have just outlined is that, just few weeks before the departure of President Macky Sall, he invited all these media bosses at State House and told them that, he is going to scrap their tax payment mounting to almost very close to 40 billion CFA francs, which is a big money. And then immediately after the elections and when the new administration came, the new president, revoked that decree taken by President Macky Sall to cancel tax payment by the media houses. And the other thing also, they have also stopped all, like National Lottery and other agencies we used to give, publicity to some of these private media houses. So the government stopped all that. As a result of that, they started facing, precarious economic situation. And the other, but the most important aspect which is affecting them is that most of their bank accounts have been, blocked by the government, thereby prevent the media houses from paying salaries or buying, materials for their publication, et cetera, and et cetera, making it very difficult for them to run their media houses.
Okay, and lastly, a pro-government daily, Le Soleil, was among several newspapers that did not follow the day without press action. Any word from the government about what is going on today?
At the moment, nothing, no word from the government, but you are very correct. Not only the pro-government newspapers like the national broadcaster, RTS and Le Soleil, but even there are some other private media houses like Wal Fajri And I also understand and others on some other, you know, press, online, which are also pro-government. They are not observing, you know, the No Press Day here in Senegal. But as we speak, there's no statement from the government, but there are different statements from civil society group which said that they are reiterating their support to the media in Senegal, because the media is facing a lot of, serious precarious economic situation. And as a result of that, if this, situation continues, they are going to close. So many media houses are going to close.
That was reporter Alpha Diallo. He spoke with me from Dakar. United Nations agencies warn Sudan is at a breaking point after more than 15 months of conflict because of what they call a crisis of neglect. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The United Nations Children's Agency reports the extent of the horrors and atrocities inflicted upon children in Sudan is going unnoticed because it is not being reported. UNICEF says the crimes committed against children go unnoticed because aid agencies have very limited access to the country's hotspots. And it says the news that trickles out is not good. Speaking from the capital, Khartoum, UNICEF spokesman James Elder says he's spoken to people who have witnessed the suffering and violence to which children are being subjected.
Yesterday in Khartoum, I spoke to a senior medical worker who gave an insight into the magnitude of sexual violence during this war. She explained she has had direct contact with hundreds of women and girls, some as young as 8 years old, who have been raped. Many have been held captive for weeks on end.
He says thousands of children have been killed or injured in the war, while sexual violence and military recruitment are increasing. The International Organization for Migration reports heavy rains and flooding are creating new hardships for thousands of people already suffering from the ongoing conflict. Speaking from Port Sudan, IOM Sudan Chief of Mission Mohamed Refat says hunger has reached catastrophic levels on a scale not seen since the Darfur crisis in the early 2000s. UN agencies have said parts of the country are on the brink of famine.
Almost all people displaced across Sudan, 97%, are in areas with acute food insecurity or worse. In 3 months, an estimated 25.6 million people will face severe food insecurity as the conflict spreads and coping mechanisms are exhausted. 1 out of 2 are struggling to put food on the table every single day.
Rafat says restrictions on humanitarian access are hampering the ability of aid agencies to save lives, particularly during the current rainy season. UN aid agencies say tens of thousands of preventable deaths will occur in the coming months without an immediate, massive, coordinated global response and the funds to mount a huge humanitarian operation. The aid official spoke as efforts continue to get U.S.-sponsored peace talks started in Geneva on Wednesday. On Monday, Tom Perriello, U.S. Special Envoy for Sudan, told journalists that the paramilitary rapid support forces have committed to taking part in the talks if the rival Sudanese armed forces also take part. So far, the National Army has not agreed to participate. Perriello also said the U.S. has spent 4 weeks trying to negotiate an agreement for a local ceasefire that would allow humanitarian aid access. This first round of peace talks is expected to last up to 10 days. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations support mission in Libya says it is monitoring with concern the recent mobilization of forces in various parts of Libya. The Libyan military has been massing forces in the west ahead of a possible clash with the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army commanded by Khalifa Haftar, which said it has been moving forces, he has been moving forces to the southeast to secure the borders with Algeria. Rhiannon Smith, managing director of the London-based LibyaAnalysis.com site, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawy whether this could lead to renewed fighting between the rival forces.
But at the moment, there hasn't been any direct fighting between the two, but I think it certainly raises the risk of some sort of miscalculation leading to some conflict. There hasn't been kind of territorial conflict between these two sides since 2020, so it would be a big development. And I don't think either kind of the GNU or the LNA really want or can afford to have such a big scale conflict. However, the LNA is keen to kind of bolster its position in the southwest, and it seems like its main aim is to take control of Khadames, which is a key strategic town on the border with Tunisia and Algeria. It also has some access to some kind of lucrative oil fields which are nearby. So it seems like that is the main aim. And I think the GNU will be loath to lose control of that area. So I think we could see in the coming days and weeks some clashes potentially around that area. However, I don't think at the moment we're likely to see that expand into wider conflict. For example, the LNA moving on Tripoli. However, the danger is that we're a very unsettled political and security dynamic at the moment as well, with other clashes going on in and around Tripoli and a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister Dbeibah in Tripoli. So I think the danger is that something that could be relatively minor in the southwest could tap into a wider instability and could lead to quite a big escalation. So it's that kind of amplification effect, which I think is of particular worry at the moment.
In a statement by the UN mission in Libya, it urges all parties to exercise maximum restraint and avoid any provocative military actions that could be perceived as offensive and might jeopardize Libya's fragile stability and safety of the people. With Russia backing General Haftar and Turkey backing the GNU, be tempted to compete to have one rival achieve a military victory?
But I would say we are at a different point in Libya to when the fighting happened around Tripoli 4 years ago, when it was very much kind of Russia backing the LNA and Turkey backing the GNU. While those alliances are still there, we have seen some thawing of relations between the sides. So Russia, you know, does have working relationships with a lot of the Western region, and Turkey actually is now completing contracts. It's met with some of the Haftar sons in eastern Libya. So there is there are ways they're working together more on the economic side. Now, that's not to say that if, for example, Turkey's military footprint and bases in western Libya were under threat, I'm sure that they would use military force to push back against that, and likewise with Russia. So I think it is definitely a concern, but I think, again, neither Russia nor Turkey want to have the kind of expense of a big military escalation. Russia is really quite happy with its position in Libya at the moment. It's able to use Libya as a kind of launching pad for its military activities in the wider Sahel and African region, and Turkey is kind of able to get some of these economic contracts and keep its bases there. So I think ideally neither side would want to see an escalation, but I think that the danger is that it only takes the wrong person to be killed or a clash unexpectedly to happen for them to be put in a position where they kind of have to escalate.
The GNU ordered the expulsion of two diplomats from the Egyptian embassy in Tripoli, accused of having carried out intelligence activities harmful to the interests of the state. The decision comes in response to the official visit of the head of the so-called Libyan Government of National Stability, based in Benghazi, Osama Hamad, in Cairo, where he was welcomed by the Egyptian Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly. How could that further accentuate already existing tensions between rival administrations in the east and the west of this country?
I think it will add to the tensions quite significantly. This is the first time that the GNS has been kind of had an official foreign visit. Egypt has kind of long been its biggest backer, but has never formally welcomed Hamad to Cairo. So I think this really highlights that Egypt and its the HOR and the Eastern kind of allies are really trying to put the pressure on Dbeibah. They want him out of Tripoli. They want a new government or the government under Hamad to kind of have control of Tripoli. So I think this is a move designed to increase those tensions and put the pressure on Dbeibah. Now, by him expelling these Egyptian diplomats, they were kind of backed into a corner. They wanted to quite try and show that they were responding in strongly. However, I think the danger is it could leave the GNU even more isolated in Tripoli.
That was Rhiannon Smith, Managing Director of the London-based LibyaAnalysis.com, speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shenawi. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Immigration is one of the top issues in the upcoming U.S. election. Vice President Kamala Harris is campaigning on her achievements as a prosecutor, while former President Donald Trump blasts the current administration's record and promises mass deportations of undocumented immigrants. VOA's immigration reporter Ilian Barros has more.
On the campaign trail, Vice President Kamala Harris highlights her background as a prosecutor, district attorney, and California Attorney General.
I walked underground tunnels between the United States and Mexico on that border with law enforcement officers. I went after transnational gangs, drug cartels, and human traffickers that came into our country illegally. I prosecuted them in case after case, and I won.
While in office, former President Donald Trump built more than 80 kilometers of new border wall, reduced the annual cap on refugee admissions to historic lows, and enforced a policy that separated children from their parents.
This November, the American people are going to compare these records, and they're going to tell Border Czar Harris, you have done a horrible job. You're a disgrace to our country. You're fired. Get out of here. You're fired. Get out.
Immigration is a hot issue in this presidential election. A Chicago Council survey found that 50% of respondents say a large number of immigrants is a threat to the United States, though just over half of Americans support a border wall and the use of American troops at the U.S.-Mexico border. Most oppose mass deportation of undocumented immigrants. With Congress failing to pass immigration reform, the nation remains dependent on executive actions and regulations, regardless of who is in office. Here's immigration lawyer Corey Foreman.
With the political environment we're in, it's a tough place because executive actions are always going to be the subjects of lawsuits, and we have a Congress that's not willing to act.
Harris pledges to support border security legislation, highlighting Trump's role in sinking a bipartisan Senate bill earlier this year.
He tanked the bipartisan deal because he thought it would help him win an election. Which goes to show Donald Trump does not care about border security. He only cares about himself. So here is my pledge to you. As president, I will bring back the border security bill that Donald Trump killed, and I will sign it into law.
Trump's Republican allies have urged him to focus on areas where they believe he has an advantage over Harris, especially on immigration. He continues to call for the deportation of undocumented migrants and criticizes the Biden-Harris administration for having what he calls an open border policy.
With your vote, inflation will stop. The illegal aliens will be turned back. They're not coming in. We got to stop them. Did you see where she's now saying, oh, we had a very good border. Oh, great. The worst border in the history of the world.
The U.S. Border Patrol logged about 130,000 migrant encounters in June, up from about 104,000 in the same month of 2019, Trump's last year before the pandemic, but down from the December 2023 peak of more than 300,000. Aline Barrows, VOA News, Washington.
The next dive, there is a census in the United States. In 2030, Americans will trace their ancestral roots to the Middle East, and North Africa will have their own demographic category, MENA. VOA's Ginia Dulot went to the Little Arabia neighborhood of Anaheim, California, to see what people think about the change.
Here in California's Little Arabian neighborhood of Anaheim, activists were fighting for a new U.S. Census category, MENA, for Americans who trace their origin to the Middle East and North Africa for over three decades. Palestinian American Aya Shihade says having to check the box white on federal forms has made her feel invisible in American society.
I always didn't feel like I fit in the white box, and so I would always try to like check off any other box, either Asian or something else. Now it could finally feel like that we're seen and that it's okay to be Palestinian, it's okay to be Arab.
MENA includes nearly 30 different identities, says Arab American Civic Council Policy and Research Coordinator Amin Nash.
It includes Iran, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, kind of the Arabian Peninsula, all the way till Palestine. And then from Africa, it'll go Egypt, and then all the way north Africa, so Egypt, Tunisia, Algeria, Libya, all the way to Morocco.
Nash says it often depends on how people see themselves culturally. For example, Israelis who are included in MENA often identify as white because they trace their ancestry to Eastern Europe, whereas Armenians, he believes, should be included in the new category because they often immigrate to the U.S. from the Middle East. Arab American Civic Council Executive Director Rashad Al-Dabakh says the new census category will help Arab Americans better advocate for their needs.
Having our own separate community means that we can have numbers, we can have data. We know how many Middle Eastern North African folks live in our communities. For us as Arab American Civic Council, it's important when we mobilize people to vote, when we talk to our Congress member, we have data. We can tell them, look, Congress member, we have this many people that live in your district. We're a big community and you should listen to our needs.
Al-Dabakh says the change will make it easier for members of his community to apply for minority business loans, to track civil rights abuses, and to look at how different healthcare issues impact MENA members. Most people here in Anaheim's Little Arabian neighborhood welcome the change. Lebanese-American Tony Hakim does not. Visiting this bakery for traditional Lebanese flatbread, he says the change is more divisive than inclusive.
And what you really want, you want people to start thinking in terms of, I'm an American, I'm here. I don't want to go back to where I came from, because where I came from, I left behind. Now I'm looking forward. Looking forward to me is being in America and being part of the American culture and identifying myself as an American.
The new MENA category will be in place for the next U.S. Census in 2030. Jenya Dulo, VOA News, in the Little Arabian neighborhood of Anaheim, California.
Sierra Leone's president says Africa cannot wait to get a bigger voice in the United Nations' most powerful body, the Security Council. President Julius Maabayo chaired a council meeting Monday. The Associated Press reports he used it to press a long-standing bid for African countries to get more council seats, including two permanent and potentially veto-wielding spots. While there's a general sense that the council needs to change, discussions have bogged down over how much to expand and what countries to include. African nations aren't the only ones that want more representation. Some are hoping for momentum from a UN Summit of the Future next month. African countries and many others have argued for reforms and arguing that the current arrangement underrepresents the continent, with the world's fastest growing population now at 1.3 billion. Africa's 54 countries make up 28% of the UN's member states. Five of the UN's 11 current peacekeeping operations are in Africa, as are four of the top 10 countries in terms of sending troops. The African Union has called for two additional elected seats, yielding a total of five, and two permanent ones for the continent.
VOA. VOA Africa has a wide variety of programs for you. News, lifestyle, health, politics, youth, women, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, television, and the internet on voaafrica.com.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Audrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.